to introduce this teach-in. So first of all, a couple of things about Platypus. So Platypus is a student organization on campus that my students founded almost 10 years ago now here at SAIC, but also at the University of Chicago, and then it's since spread to other schools around the world, and it's still a registered student organization here. So anyway, I was asked to give a teach-in on the phenomenon of the Trump campaign in this election in 2016. And this is part of the mission of Platypus, in that Platypus is an educational project primarily about the left and Marxism and socialism, but also about politics and society. And so it's a little bit unusual for us to address a right-wing phenomenon like Trump. We usually address leftist phenomena, but because Trump fits into a constellation of events that took place this year, like the Sanders campaign, because can't really understand the Trump campaign without the Sanders campaign, and vice versa. And other things that have been going on, like the crisis of the EU with the Brexit vote that took place. We decided that we would address this, which is a little bit unusual for us. Also, primarily the events that we do on campus, both here and at other schools, are not this kind of a teach-in event, but really a conversation between different opinions on the left. And we're going to be holding an event in the School of the Art Institute on electoral politics, third parties, and the left in October. And this is a kind of a lead-up event to that, to considering the election in general. Let me say a couple of things about myself. So I've been teaching, I'm Chris Catrone, I've been teaching here at the School of the Art Institute for about 12 years now, and I teach primarily critical theory, Marxist critical theory, in the art history department in the visual critical studies program. And so I concentrate mostly on the Frankfurt School, on Walter Benjamin and Theodor Adorno's work, and usually in terms of cultural criticism, but also in terms of social and political history. And I wanted to say a couple of things about this event. So this event comes out of an article that we published that I wrote that's meant to be provocative, and that's also meant to be a provocation not towards a general public audience, but rather towards a very specific audience, namely a leftist audience, and that's the Why Not Trump article. But let me start out by saying that an alternate title for this event that would be, in a sense, less provocative and more accurate would be How Not to Oppose Trump. In other words, the problems with the left's approach to Trump and the left's opposition to Trump, such as it is, because in fact, as I'll discuss, some of the left actually want Trump to win because they'll see it as an opportunity to protest and also as a way of punishing the Democrats for nominating Hillary instead of Sanders. So this format, the teach-in format, it goes back to the 1960s, to the New Left. And it comes out of the idea that professors can do something other than just teach academic material, but can also help students get a handle on and deal with contemporary phenomena. And so approaching this, you know, I was thinking about it in terms of, okay, well, first of all, I'm an intellectual, and second of all, I'm a teacher, and third of all, I'm an academic, meaning not all intellectuals are teachers and not all teachers are in academia. And so there are a couple of things to consider with respect to that. Namely, I consider Trump first and foremost to be something that I have to think about and that I think students need to think about. As a teacher, I have to bring experience and, if you will, knowledge and wisdom to bear in terms of how I could help you guys think about this phenomenon. But also in academia. Academia is a kind of default Democratic Party environment. And so certainly my own education, I went to college at Hampshire College in Massachusetts, and I've always gone to like lefty schools, and even though I got my PhD at the University of Chicago, and the University of Chicago has a reputation for being conservative, it's really not that conservative. In other words, they have a few right-wing faculty, but the general campus culture there is still liberal leftish. And certainly in my area in the humanities, there are really no conservatives whatsoever. The conservatives are like isolated in like the economics department that nobody ever goes to anyway. As such, I also wanted to say a couple of things about my own personal background, since this is not a kind of formal academic exercise, but rather a teach-in, meaning it's a kind of extracurricular and really meant to address students at a more personal level. about my own background. So I'm old enough to have lived through the Reagan Revolution and also the Democratic Party's accommodation and assimilation to the Reagan Revolution, namely Bill Clinton's election in 1992. And now I've lived long enough to see the Reagan Revolution unravel in certain key respects. And my own background, I'm from New York, and so I also bring to bear a long familiarity with Donald Trump as a figure, as a public figure, from the 1980s. And also, you know, him being from Queens, whatever that means, but, you know, like, basically, that's a very similar sociological picture, apart from the millionaire-billionaire status, it's the quintessential Archie Bunker borough of New York. My own family, being Italian-American, working class, I would say anecdotally, are a perfect picture of your Trump voter, and at least in a particular kind of framework. Namely, they voted for Obama, and now they're going to vote for Trump. And there are a lot of people like this. And so that's something else that I have to bring to bear. Also, personally, I'm married to a devout Muslim immigrant, and whose Muslim friends and family are about evenly split between people who will vote for Trump and people who will vote for Hillary. And so this is reality that we have to engage with. Certainly, coming from New York and living in Illinois, living in Chicago for so long, living in a liberal environment and academia for so long, I certainly have a skewed perspective. And certainly even my family as a kind of Trump voting phenomenon is a skewed perspective. They're the quintessential Reagan Democrats. Catholic, working class, these are the people that Reagan won from the Democratic Party and who switched back to Obama and are now sort of floating back towards the Republicans, but only with Trump. And I feel like if Hillary were to drop out and Biden were to run, they would switch again. They would vote for Biden instead of Trump, actually. So there's this whole milieu that I'm going to be bringing to bear and sort of intoning and keeping in the back of my mind in terms of informing the conversation. But I wanted to start off with clips, just three short clips, and maybe one more fourth short clip from Friday from the Trump campaign, namely three clips from the Republican National Convention in July and this bizarre phenomenon of a Trump rally in Miami that Trump spoke at where they've appropriated the song from Les Mis, Do You Hear the People Sing? Right, and they've appropriated it in terms of calling themselves the deplorables, like les deplorables, like the Les Miserables. Right. So I just want to sort of look at this, and the three clips are a little bit unusual, and we're not going to look at like Trump himself or anything that boring. We're going to look at some of the speakers around Trump who really made this Republican National Convention quite different from what it had been in the past. Oh, hold on, I'm not getting the sound. Hold on, let me make sure that we've got the sound. Why people turn off the HDMI sound. HDMI. Live streaming this, and so
can you turn off the sound on the live stream?
Can you No. I don't know. Oh, maybe. Nope.
Do you see it there where it says monitor? Is that possible?
Which one?
It's on the bottom left.
The bottom left?
Next, it's above stop.
Oh, up here. Okay. All right. So we want to do off.
Oh.
Though it's still, I think it's still recording. Just not going to be monitoring. So let's see if that. No, we got it. Still got.
Let's shut some videos.
Well, you're going to miss something with that. All right, so we may not be able to do this. Maybe you guys were able to watch these already before, like they were on the Facebook invite now. Shit.
How could we?
It's going to be a mute function, another kind of mute function.
Yeah.
Ant, what do you think? Oh.
Recording.
Oh, I could do this. Hold on. I'm doing this. And put volume all the way down. All right, there it is. I'll put the input volume back up. Still no playing. Okay, that's the end. All right, we'll have to skip this. Oh well, skip the videos, I guess. We'll lose us something, but alright, so skip the videos, but we'll turn to the not only the Why Not Trump article that Platypus had me write and publish, but also something that I wrote in response to a German leftist journal this summer, a postscript to an article on the Sanders campaign after the primaries were over. So it's in June. This is just to lay out some basic ideas. So the primary elections for the nomination of the Democrat and Republican candidates for president demonstrated the depth and extent of the disarray of the two parties. Sanders successfully challenged Hillary beyond being a mere messenger of protest to become a real contender for the Democratic Party nomination. But this was on the basis of the Democrats' established constituencies and so limited Sanders' reach. Turnout for the Democratic primaries was not significantly raised as Sanders had hoped. The Republican primaries, by contrast, reached new highs. Donald Trump is the actual phenomenon of crisis and potential change in 2016, taking a much stronger initiative in challenging the established Republican Party, indeed offering the only convincing possibility of defeating Clinton. The significant crossover support between Sanders and Trump, however marginal, is indicative of this crisis. Trump has elicited hysteria, and this is what we're really going to be talking about, among both established Republicans and Democrats. Their hysteria says more about them than about him, namely fear of the base. Sanders attempted to oppose the 1930s and 1940s New Deal and 1960s and 1970s Great Society and New Left base of the Democratic Party, established and developed from FDR through the Nixon years, against its 1980s to 2010s neoliberal leadership that has allegedly abandoned them. Trump has done something similar, winning back from Obama the Reagan Democrats, but the wild opportunism of his demagogy allows him to transcend any inherent limitations of this appeal. Trump is no fascist, nor even really a populist, but is precisely what the Republicans accuse him of being, a New York-style Democrat. Like the socially and economically liberal, but blowhard law and order conservative, former 1980s New York City Mayor Ed Koch. And they were contemporaries. They didn't like each other much, but they were politically very similar. And one of the things we can talk about is the Central Park jogger case, the Central Park Five, where both Trump and Koch were really, you know, beating the drum, you know, to prosecute these poor kids who were innocent. Trump challenges Hillary precisely because they occupy such similar moderate centrist positions on the US political spectrum, whatever their various differences on policy. And that's one of the things that I'd like to talk about today, the difference between politics and policy. Trump, more than Sanders, represents something new and different in this election season, a potential post and not pre-neoliberal form of capitalist politics regarding changes in policies that have continued from Reagan through Obama, driven by discontents of those alienated from both parties. Trump has successfully run against and seeks to overthrow the established Republican 1980s era Reagan Revolution coalition of neoliberals, neoconservatives, strict construction constitutionalist conservatives, and evangelical Christian fundamentalists, against their always uneasy alliance, as well as against all of that alliance's component parts. Established Republicans recoil at undoing the Reagan coalition that they have mobilized since the 1980s. Marco Rubio, as well as Ted Cruz, both of whom were adolescents in the 1980s. They're both my age, which also makes me really dislike them. denounced Trump not only for his New York values, but also indicatively as a socialist. They called him a socialist. Glenn Beck said that Trump meant that the America of statism of the progressives Theodore Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson had won over the America of freedom of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. Of course, that is ideological and leaves aside the problem of capitalism, which Trump seeks to reform. Sanders could have potentially bested Trump as a candidate for reform, perhaps, but only on the basis of a much greater and more substantial mobilization for a different politics than it is evidently possible to muster through the Democrats, whose nostalgia for the New Deal, Great Society, and New Left does not provide the necessary resources. Trump has succeeded precisely where Sanders failed in marshaling the discontents with neoliberalism and demand for change. Sanders collapsed into the Democratic Party. To succeed, Sanders would have needed to run against the Democrats the way Trump ran against the Republicans. This would have meant challenging the ruling Democratic neoliberal combination of capitalist austerity with new left identity politics of race, gender, and sexuality that is the corporate status quo. The results of Trump's contesting of Reaganite and Clintonian and Obama-era neoliberalism remain to be seen. We don't know whether it will work or not. The biggest party, however, remains those who don't vote. So normally between 40 and 50% of the population votes, and that means that the Republicans and the Democrats are basically fighting over that 40 to 50%. They're getting about 25, 30% each, which means that the biggest chunk are the people who don't vote, in fact. Trump will win if he mobilizes more of the people who normally don't vote than Clinton does. Clinton is conservative in this election. Trump is the candidate for change. The Republicans have been in crisis, and the reason for that is that the Republicans have been in crisis in ways that the Democrats are not. And this is the political opportunity expressed by Trump. He is seeking to lead the Yahoos to the center, as well as meeting their genuine discontents in neoliberalism. Of course, the change Trump represents is insufficient and perhaps unworkable, but it is nonetheless necessary, meaning there is a crisis of neoliberalism, something's going to change. Things must change, they will change, but as Marx said, all that is solid melts into air. The future of any potential struggle for socialism in the United States will be on a basis among not only those who have voted for Sanders, but also among those who have and will vote for Trump, meaning these are not. We treat them as completely beyond the pale, the deplorables. We're going to be giving up on something in terms of the United States. All right, so this is a little bit different tack. This is getting into what's been going on the last couple of months, namely now that we're in the election, the kind of opposition to Trump that's manifested. So, like I said earlier, I titled this Why Not Trump to be provocative. The title of this teach-in would really more accurately be How Not to Oppose Trump. Namely, how not to oppose Trump, not the way the Democrats oppose Trump. If one blows all the smoke away, one is left with the obvious question, why not Trump? Trump's claim to the presidency is twofold, that he's a successful billionaire businessman and that he's a political outsider. His political opponents must dispute both these claims. But Trump is as much a billionaire and as much a successful businessman and as much a political outsider as anyone else. Trump says he's fighting against a rigged system. No one can deny that the system is rigged. And I have a personal anecdote from the primaries that I can attest to this, voting in Chicago. Trump is opposed by virtually the entire mainstream political establishment, Republican and Democrat, and by the entire mainstream news media, conservative and liberal alike. Even Fox News has a hard time getting themselves wrapped around Trump. And yet, even with that almost unanimous opposition, he could win. That says something. It says that there is something there. Trump has successfully run against and seeks to overthrow the established Republican era Reagan Revolution coalition of neoliberals, neoconservatives, strict constructionists, constitutionalist conservatives, and evangelical fundamentalists against their alliance as well as all of its parts. It is remarkable that such a vociferous opposition is mounted against what is really a moderate political figure as Trump, who until not long ago was a centrist, moderate conservative Democrat. So he endorsed Dukakis, he even endorsed Jesse Jackson, and he even endorsed Clinton, and is now a centrist, moderate conservative Republican. There were many Republicans in the primaries who were more conservative, who were to the right of Trump in primaries. And he's running against a moderate conservative Democrat, Hillary. Trump claims to be the last chance for change. This may in fact be true. Indeed, it is useful to treat all of Trump's claims as true. Useful, and we'll get to why it's useful in a moment. It's useful to treat his claims as true and to treat all those by his adversaries as false. For when Trump lies, still his lies tell the truth. When Trump's opponents tell the truth, they still lie. For example, when Trump appears to be ignorant of the ways of the world, he expresses a wisdom about the status quo. The apparent wisdom of the status quo, by contrast, is the most pernicious form of ignorance. For example, Trump says that the official current unemployment rate of 5% is a lie, that there are more than 20% out of work, most of whom have stopped seeking employment altogether. It is a permanent and not fluctuating condition. Trump points out that this is unacceptable. Mainstream economists say that Trump's comments about this are not false, but rather unhelpful, because nothing can be done about it. The neoliberal combination of capitalist austerity with post-60s identity politics of race, gender, and sexuality that is the corporate status quo means allowing greater profits, and the reason that greater profits are permitted now than in the 60s is because there has been lower capitalist growth overall since the 1970s. So we've lived in a low growth period the last 40 years. And so to keep capital flowing, to keep people interested in investing, you have to let them get higher profit rates than in the past. So you allow greater profits while including more minorities and women in the workforce and in management. Trump is attacking this not out of racism or misogyny, but rather against the lowered expectations of the new normal. And we could talk about the new normal in two respects, one since the 70s and the other more recently since 2008, since the economic crisis. When Trump says that he will provide jobs for all Americans, this is not a lie, even though he wouldn't be able to do that. It's not a lie, but rather bourgeois ideology, which is different. The mendacity of the status quo is the deeper problem. And I'm going to talk about the relationship between lies and mendacity, meaning there's like lies and then there's mendacity, which is a little bit different. For instance, Trump's catchphrase, "Make America Great Again," has the virtue of straightforward meaning. It is the opposite of Obama's "Change You Can Believe In," which means not really any change because we don't really believe in change, so it's the change you can believe in. Or in Hillary's "Stronger Together," meaning you better stick with me, kid. These have the quality of the old McDonald's slogan, "What you want is what you get," which meant that you will like it just as they give it to you. Replaced by today's simpler, "I'm loving it." But what if we're not loving it? What if we don't accept what Hillary says against Trump, that America is great already? When Trump says, I'm with you, this is in opposition to Hillary's, we're with her. Hillary is better for that gendered pronoun. Trump promises to govern for everyone and proudly claims that he will be boring as president. There's no reason not to believe him. Everything Trump calls for exists already. There is already surveillance and increased scrutiny of Muslim immigrants in the war on terror. There is already a war against ISIS. There is already a wall on the border with Mexico. There's already a wall. There are already mass deportations of quote-unquote illegal immigrants. There are already proposals that will be implemented anyway for a super exploited guest worker immigration program. International trade is heavily regulated with many protections favoring US corporations already in place. Hillary will not change any of this. Given the current crisis of global capitalism, international trade is bound to be reconfigured anyway. In other words, the one thing that Trump claims he's going to do, trade is going to change anyway, regardless of whether it's Hillary or Trump. One change, unlikely under Clinton, that Trump advocates, shifting from supporting Saudi Arabia to détente with Russia, for instance, in Syria. Would this be a bad thing? We're to believe that that's a bad thing, that we would switch from supporting Saudi Arabia to supporting Russia? But everything is open to compromise, right? After all, he told the editorial board of the New York Times in private conversation that the wall was just a negotiating position. Everything is open to compromise. Trump says only that he thinks he can get a better deal for America. He campaigns to be not a dictator, but the negotiator in chief, to do essentially what's already being done, but smarter and more effectively. And yet this is shocking the system. One example of the better deal for America business is the, he offered John Kasich the vice presidential nomination. And he said, he offered to John Kasich that John Kasich would be in charge of domestic and foreign policy. And John Kasich said, well, then what will you be in charge of? And he said, I'll be in charge of making America great again. Okay, so when he's called a narcissist who cares only for himself, for instance, by Pocahontas, Senator Elizabeth Warren, one of his choice insults, this is by those who are part of an elaborate political machine for maintaining the status quo, who are evidently resentful that he doesn't need to play by their rules. In other words, that's what it means for an established politician to say he's a narcissist, means that he's allowed to act his own way, whereas they all have to follow the script. This includes the ostensible left, which has a vested interest. So the established left that's out there has a vested interest in continuing to do things as they have been done already for a long time. The left is thus nothing of the sort. They don't believe change is possible, or they find any potential change undesirable because it's too challenging. If change is difficult and messy, that doesn't make it evil, but what one fears tends to be regarded as evil. Their scaremongering is self-serving, it's self-interested. It is they who care only for themselves, their way of doing things, and their positions. But as true narcissists, they confuse this as caring for others. These others are only extensions of themselves. Trump says that he doesn't need this. He doesn't need to be president. Whereas Hillary, you wonder what would happen to her. She would have like an existential crisis. She's never president. She might just like explode in a puff of smoke. He doesn't need this, and he's running to serve the country. This is true. We have to treat all these politicians as wanting to serve the country. The only difference between Trump and Hillary is that he doesn't need it. I mean, she wants to serve the country too in her own, you know, she has her own concept of what that means. Trump's appeal is not all that extreme, but it is indeed extreme to claim that anyone who listens to him is beyond the boundaries of acceptable politics. So the deplorables fund, that's an extreme statement. The election results in November, whatever their outcome, will show just how many people are counted out by the political status quo, how many people are counted as the deplorables. The silent majority will speak. The only question is how resoundingly they do so. Will they be discouraged? Because this election will really be about each side is trying to discourage the other one's voters, right? So they're each trying to depress the other's voters. That's how it's really going to be decided. Many who voted for Obama will vote for Trump. Enough so that he could win. And that's important to bear in mind. Even Trump said that he had hopes in Obama and he was disappointed. He's not only speaking for himself, he's speaking for a lot of people. This leads to the inescapable conclusion, anti-Trumpism is the problem and the obstacle, not Trump. Meaning when we look at all the opposition to Trump, that's the status quo. And that's the problem and obstacle. The status quo thinks that change is only incremental and gradual. Anything else is either impossible or undesirable. But really, the only changes they're willing to accept prove to be no changes at all. This recalls the character in Voltaire's novel Candide, Professor Pangloss, who said that we live in the best of all possible worlds. No one on the avowed left should think such a thing, and yet they evidently do. There is significant ambivalence on the far left about opposing Trump and supporting Hillary, a more or less secret wish for Trump that is either kept quiet or else psychologically denied to oneself functions here. There is a desire to punish the Democrats for nominating such an openly conservative candidate, for instance, by voting for the Greens' Jill Stein, which would help Trump win. The recent Brexit vote in the UK shows that when people are given the opportunity, they reject the status quo. The status quo response to this has been that they should not have been given that opportunity. In other words, that the vote itself was wrong. Finding Trump acceptable is not outrageous. But the outrageous anti-Trumpism, the relentless spinning and lying of the status quo defending itself, is actually not acceptable, not if any political change whatsoever is desired. In all the nervous hyperventilation of the complacent status quo under threat, there is the obvious question that is avoided, but must be asked by anyone not too frightened to think, by anyone trying to think seriously about politics, especially possibilities for change, why not Trump? For which the only answer is to preserve the status quo. Not against worse, that might be beyond any US president's control anyway, but simply for things as they already are. And we should not accept things as they already are. So, why not Trump? All right, so that's my presentation. So let's open up for a little bit of discussion. I mentioned that I'm old enough to have lived through both the Reagan Revolution and now its undoing. And so this question is not meant to be simply rhetorical, why not Trump? It's also meant to be literal in the sense of what are the actual reasons? In other words, not the scare tactics, not all of that, but what are the actual reasons? What's the reason to expect Trump to actually be worse than Hillary? There are many reasons, but they're usually not the ones that are discussed in the mainstream media. In other words, there are many reasons why one could say one would be worse than the other. I don't think that it's possible to say that one would be better than the other, exactly. But you could say maybe one is worse than the other. Lesser evilism, right? You could make that argument. You could say it's a lesser evil. And certainly my own position as someone who teaches here at the School of the Art Institute and lives in the city of Chicago, lives in the state of Illinois, it would be in my personal interest that Hillary is elected. You know, perhaps as a gay person, it would be in my personal interest, although Trump is kind of tolerant of gay people, the Republicans are not. But that, you know, the question of one's personal interest is actually a little bit different from reason. Because after all, we're not just talking about personal self-interest, we're talking about the country and the world. In other words, we're talking about a political choice, not just a personal choice. I think that I mentioned earlier the rigged system, so since I mentioned the personal anecdote, I will explain. So I went to vote in the primary in my precinct, which is in Uptown on the north side. And it's in Buena Park, so it's a predominantly white precinct, and progressive though. And so, you know, people from my building were there, I was there. And you know, we're all there to vote for Sanders. So they basically, when you vote in a primary, there are two lines. There's the Democratic line and there's the Republican line. As it turned out, they didn't have the ballots for the Democratic line properly. They had switched it with another precinct. And so we didn't have the proper ballots, and so they said, well, you can fill out a provisional ballot, but the judge said, and he was the Democratic judge, he said, but I can tell you they won't be counted. Yeah, and of course, where did they switch the ballot with? With a precinct in Lakeview. In other words, another district that would have gone for Sanders, right? So basically, they nullified two potentially Sanders voting precincts that I personally know of. So there was a long line because you could do the electronic. You could do instead of the paper, but there was only one machine. And so it made the line very long. And so, of course, people stopped waiting. A lot of people, because Buena Park is a kind of a wealthy area, so a lot of people were on the phone immediately with the media, like reporting this, et cetera. I, on the other hand, was like, fuck this, and I switched lines. And I voted for Trump on the Republican line. Because I was like, look, I came down here to vote. I've been waiting for a half an hour. I'm going to vote for somebody. My vote's going to count. And so fuck it. I decided Sanders was going to lose Illinois anyway. I wanted him to lose by a very narrow margin. I figured Trump was going to win, and I wanted Trump to win by a greater margin, meaning I wanted Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio. I think Rubio was out. It was Kasich and Cruz at that point when Illinois rolled around. Anyway, I was like, Trump's going to win anyway, and he needs to demolish these people. And Sanders is going to lose anyway. I wish that he wouldn't lose by that much, but it's not like my vote was going to put him over the top or something. But it still struck me. It still struck me. And I was like, oh my God. You know, it was shameless, too. It was shameless. And that went on. In other words, that was definitely not just my precinct and another precinct. And it not only went on in Illinois, but also in other states. So that's real. It didn't decide things, but it contributed to them. And you know, Illinois and Chicago are notorious for Democratic Party voting stuff. So anyway, that's just, you know, not to make too much of it, but unfortunately, I personally experienced the rigged system. Yeah. So anyway, let's open it up a little bit.
My question is kind of
I should also say I oppose Trump. I don't support or endorse him in any way. I completely oppose him because I oppose all the law and order bullshit, which is the way that I understand the immigration and the war on terror bullshit. Meaning he puts everything through a kind of law and order conservatism, and I don't agree with any of that. I believe that anyone living, working in the United States, should have the same rights as anyone else. Yeah, I completely oppose all that bullshit. But anyway, sorry.
No, it's okay.
Yeah, go ahead.
It can be pretty easily demonstrated that, as you pointed out, when you really break down the policies that either candidate would be putting in place, they're about the same, right? So it's really just a matter of rhetoric.
Rhetoric. Uh-huh.
So, you know, how is it that we can consider, even in a provocative way, how could we, you know, kind of put the idea forth that Trump could be a candidate for change if he's simply just in a dogmatic way preaching for the kind of policies that would happen anyways?
Let me qualify the change bit. So, of course, I don't see it as change in the sense of like substantial change in capitalism or something like that. Mm-hmm. I see it as change in the Republican Party, first of all, and second of all, in the nature of conservatism. In other words, that it's a shift from a kind of culture wars conservatism to a straight up capitalist economic conservatism. And I see that as good in the sense that I don't think that the future of American politics belongs to the kind of 80s era culture wars. Like, I don't think that that's really going to be the way it divides up the two parties anyway. But Hillary's trying to run on that. And she's trying to cast Trump as a 80s style Reaganite Republican, which he's not. And so the interesting thing is that they have to cast him as a culture wars conservative, even though he himself is not. And he's actually running against that. And that's why I wanted to show the Peter Thiel and also the Pastor Mark Burns and the Muslims for Trump benediction at the RNC. And then obviously the late déplorable, the deplorables, the appropriation of Les Mis. So the question is the rhetoric. So a couple of things. So, you know, I gave myself this task last summer of taking Trump seriously because I knew that, I knew from the beginning that Trump was probably going to win the nomination. And I thought he had a good chance of defeating Hillary. I also felt that Sanders was going to do well. I thought that Sanders could win both the candidacy and the presidency. And so I thought there was a good chance of it being Sanders versus Trump and Sanders winning. I thought that that was possible. And I thought pretty much that Trump, who I otherwise wouldn't have taken seriously at all, but when he announced last year, I felt like, okay, actually, this is probably going to work. And so I looked at, you know, his, like, Make America Great Again, or Crippled America, it's like his book, like, describing his program, and I looked at his policy positions, and I watched his speeches, and, you know, including the crazy announcement speech that he started out with, and I followed the news around his campaign. And so the rhetoric on the Trump side, so it turns out he wanted to run starting when Romney lost in 2012. So the day after the election in 2012, he trademarked Make America Great Again. And so like he immediately like, you know, jumped on it. And then he and this guy Jeff Sessions and also, who's Roger Ailes? He's the Nixon era guy. So they concocted this idea that how they're going to defeat the other Republicans. And they decided that they would defeat the other Republicans by making immigration their issue. So it's not why he was running to begin with. He was running on the trade issue. But they decided that the way that they would distinguish themselves, especially from Marco Rubio, because he had been one of the immigration reform senators, the Gang of Eight, who failed to pass immigration reform, that he would make that his wedge issue. And so that's how they distinguished themselves from the other candidates, although not by having the most hard line on immigration, because in fact Cruz has a harder line on immigration than Trump. But rather that, again, it would be the most rhetoric, the most bluster, like because they knew that they had to knock out Jeb Bush and Rubio. And they knew that they could basically make a rhetorical distinction, even if it's not really a policy distinction on immigration. Because after all, as we know, his position on immigration is actually the same as theirs, right? And so the question is, and that's, you know, the question is, as a wedge issue, does that explain all of the appeal? The media would have us believe that that is his core issue. But his core issue is obviously trade. But it's harder for the media to deal with trade as a core issue because, in fact, it's rather opaque as an issue. It's unclear whether he can change anything about trade. It's, you know, and because Hillary has flip-flopped on stuff on the TPP and whatever. And so it's easier to make it into identity politics, racism, ethnic scapegoating, right, and to carry that through. In other words, it becomes a fight over the Latino vote, basically. And, you know, the Democrats have their way of dealing with that, and the Republicans had their way of dealing with it, which Trump has trashed. And so the establishment Republicans hate him for that. But the rhetoric, you know, again, the question is means and ends. In other words, he has used, you know, despicable rhetoric. But the question is that the end that he's pursuing, or is it the means to an end? And if it's the means to an end, the question is, well, what are the ends? Like, what is he, you know, what is he going to do if he's elected? I mean, basically, you know, what I'm here to do in terms of this teach-in is to say a couple of things. One is, he could win. And the other is, be prepared. Because I, you know, as I mentioned, I was old enough to live through the Reagan Revolution. That means that I'm old enough to see how the left and also not just the far left, but also like people in general, the sort of center, if you will, never quite made sense of the Reagan Revolution. Like it kind of just hit them and they never were able to quite make sense of it. And really the last 30 or 40 years has been about what is this neoliberalism? How do we understand it? You know, what is the relationship between the Clintons and the Reagan Revolution? Like, how do we, you know, grasp neoliberalism as a phenomenon on the side of both parties? But really, people thought that Reagan was a joke and there's no way he could be president. He won. right? And people never recovered from that. And so what I dread about the Trump phenomenon is that if he wins, I feel like people will never actually be able to make sense of it. And so I feel like, but actually we can kind of make sense of it, at least negatively. In other words, Reagan, like Trump, took advantage of a weakness of the Republican Party. In other words, what he did was transform the Republican Party, and that's what Trump is trying to do. And it affects the other party, meaning Reagan's transformation of the Republican Party affected the Democratic Party. Whatever happens, especially if Trump wins, though, it's going to affect the Democrats. And it probably will split the Democrats between two groups of people, those who say we should have nominated Sanders, and those who will blame Sanders for weakening Hillary as a candidate. Because there will be people who will do that, who will basically blame Trump's victory on the Sanders campaign. They'll blame it on the Sanders or bust people. They'll blame it on poor what's-her-name at the Democratic National Convention.
Schultz.
The actress from Thelma and Louise?
Oh.
No, Sarah Silverman. She was terrible. She was like the die-hard Hillaryite. Susan Sarandon. Susan Sarandon. They'll blame poor Susan Sarandon if Trump wins. They'll be like, it's because Grumpy Cat Super Susan Sarandon was on TV too much at the DNC. Yeah. So if he wins, it's going to be a change that people are going to struggle to make sense of, but we can kind of get out of the curve and think about it now. So that's, you know, the rhetoric, the question is whether the rhetoric is going to characterize the administration or whether the rhetoric is greasing the wheels of the campaign. Meaning, you know, is, you know, I mean, he promises to build the wall, he promises this and that, but what is he actually, you know, he says, for instance, to make America great again, first you have to have a country. You can't have a country without borders, blah, 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 blah. Of course, no one can stop illegal immigration. The only thing that you can do is make immigrants suffer. You can't actually stop illegal immigration. That's not possible. So all you can do is like make people suffer. So like I said, that's, of course, deplorable. It really is deplorable.
Crazy.
On the one hand. On the other hand, when he says, first we have to have a country before we can make it great again, what does he mean by make it great again? In other words, he doesn't mean, you know, as he's at pains to say, he doesn't mean keeping out all immigrants, right, at all. Right? He just says he wants it to be legal. And that's what I point out, that, or it's up there anyway, that what the immigration reform that they've been talking about since 2006 for 10 years, I'm opposed to it. Meaning what it is a tiered system, meaning that you give people, and that's why he points to Operation Wetback, because what the Operation Wetback with the Eisenhower administration, what it was actually a way of regulating legal immigration, meaning they had the Braceros program in World War II where they brought in Mexican labor because of the war industries, and they kept it going in the 1950s. And basically what it meant was that Mexican workers were paid less. And so that's what they want now. In other words, they want a legal system for paying people less, as opposed to paying people less because they're undocumented. They want to basically say, now we have a legal right to pay people less than minimum wage. Right? And so that's, of course, horrible. But that's what's going to happen, Hillary or Trump. That's the immigration reform that they've been promising all these years. Why they haven't been able to achieve it is because the capitalists actually don't want it. And so why do we have the deportations? Because in fact, first George W. Bush and now Obama is trying to pressure the capitalists by attacking their workforce. In other words, it's actually a political tactic to try to force the capitalists to get on board with the immigration reform that otherwise they don't want. And that's why they only target some businesses, and it's very carefully orchestrated. And it started under Bush and it continues under Obama. And because Hillary will also want to still push this immigration reform, she will also have to resort to deportations to try to pressure the capitalists into accepting it.
See, to kind of piggyback onto your policy issues, mm-hmm. and immigration and the rest of them, see, when you talk about make America great again, I really think Trump is talking about make America great again for him, personally.
personally.
And for his business. He's self-serving to the hilt, and the things he talks about as policy are nothing.
You mean he'll give himself a tax break or something?
Just gibberish, and I could see him conducting business while he's president, even though he says he won't. But the big comparison or analogy that I see here is I look at Trump like, and I don't know if the rest of the people here would remember a movie called Being There with Peter Sellers.
Mm-hmm.
Check out the movie Being There.
It's a comedy. It's good, though.
It's a comedy, but it's about a guy who is basically a functional moron. And he is put in a position
of authority,
of authority and around power, and he had and politics, and he had spin doctors that basically translated his speech into coherent policies. He said, "Well, what he really means is this," and
so this is actually, I would say this is part of the problem with the way people tend to approach Trump. See, because I remember him from back in the day, from the 1980s, he's been saying the same thing for 30 years. In other words, he actually does have, like, a program. He does have a vision. And whether it's workable or not is another thing. But he does have his principles. He does. It's not just gibberish and it's not just self-serving. Because he's threatened to run for president on several occasions, and it's always been on this trade issue business. And it's always been on the idea that America gets a bad deal, both with trade and with respect to its defense agreements with the allies, both with Saudi Arabia and with the European allies and Japan and South Korea. He's been running on that, like, idea. He hasn't been running a political campaign, but that idea has been in his head for 30 years. And he's always been a law and order guy, too. And that's why people talk about how there's a disconnect, because he's really, his consciousness of law and order is really from the crime wave and the crime hysteria of the 80s. And of course now it's like, what are you talking about, right? But, you know, he does have his principles, and he has his worldview, if you will. And Trump could not have been Trump until now. In other words, what you have is this guy who's had the same ideas for 30 years, and he's meeting a historical moment today. And so he could not have won the Republican nomination. He could not have come close to becoming president 4 years ago, or 8 years ago, or 12 years ago, or 20 years ago. So it's about the man who's the same, and the moment, which is now. And, you know, in other words, Trump has had an idea, and it's an idea whose time has come. And, of course, it's bizarre because it's this 80s idea. But nonetheless, here it is. And it's an 80s idea that in the 80s caused him to support the Democrats against the Republicans. In other words, that same idea that he has today that he had 30 years ago made him support the Democrats. And so, in other words, he was against the Reaganites. Not initially, because he actually, the first 2 years of Reagan, he like cozied up to Reagan, but then very quickly moved against Reaganism, and he really didn't like George Herbert Walker Bush. And so he's been on that trajectory, and like I said, he liked Clinton in 1992. You know, he's had the same, and then he feels like Clinton betrayed, because of course you know that he hates NAFTA, Trump. So NAFTA was negotiated by George Herbert Walker Bush, but approved by Clinton. In other words, it was really done before Clinton. And then Clinton said that he wouldn't sign it, but then he got into office and signed it. And that's the beginning of Trump's drift away from the Democrats, basically. So he's had the same monomaniacal focus, actually. The immigration stuff is recent. The immigration stuff is, again, his wedge issue. It's what he decided, you know, him and his, like, consiglieres or dark arts masters or whatever, you know, these people. That's what they cooked up.
I also see Trump and Clinton as placeholders, though.
Mm.
And they're only going to be one-term people, whoever wins, because of their age and other things.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Republicans and I believe Sanders is going to surface in 4 years under
a different
under new titles, mm-hmm. and I think that's when not Sanders himself, but mm-hmm. the Sanders movement is going to
come back.
Worse.
I mean, hopefully. I mean, the interesting thing about 2016, to my mind, is the conjuncture, and I think about it in terms of the Reagan Revolution, because Reagan had been running for president for quite some time. He ran in 68 in the Republican primaries. He ran again in 76, and then finally won the nomination in 1980. And so there was a way in which Reagan came kind of too late, meaning he was the man of his moment, but he was also stuck in a kind of 50s, 60s kind of framework. But then the man met the moment. But I think individuals do matter. In other words, I think Sanders and Trump are kind of unique figures. And the change, the configuration of change that they represent won't come back after this year. Meaning, I think the Republicans will change, the Democrats will change in one way or another. But this kind of weird moment we've had, 2015, 2016, of Sanders-Trumpism, it probably won't come back in quite that way. It's going to have to find some other way. And Elizabeth Warren, you know, who I kind of single out here because she does kind of annoy me, she's also a peculiar character because she was a Republican who became a Democrat. And she became a Democrat because of the banking stuff. And so she was a Republican who basically said that the Republicans were not fiscally responsible. And so she became a Democrat in order to be a voice for fiscal responsibility. And fiscal responsibility is always a very treacherous concept. A lot of right-wing shit goes on under the rubric of fiscal responsibility. So that's one thing that I don't like about Elizabeth Warren.
But isn't Trump advocating that too?
No, he's saying he doesn't care about the deficit.
Yeah?
Yeah.
He's I can't always tell what he's saying. That's part of the problem, Trump, is he's so kind of all over the map in a way.
He's throwing sops to the Republicans. He's keeping his base, but he's already said on various occasions that he would seek to renegotiate the debt and all these things. And you know, the debt is a bogus issue, by the way. Like, national debt is a bogus issue. And Obama wanted to do, and Hillary will do, the privatization of Social Security. In other words, they'll dump Social Security into Wall Street. And Trump has said that he won't do that. That's one thing that he said, that he will defend Social Security.
Well, that's true.
And that's a big deal. In terms of fiscal responsibility, the thing that's going to break the bank in the United States is Social Security.
I've heard arguments against that, too.
Hmm?
I've heard arguments against that. I mean, because basically what they do is they suck up the Social Security.
They use it anyway.
They use it, yeah.
Yeah, but yeah, it's like, and then also he's, yeah, it's like this weird, no, I mean, he's a conservative, don't get me wrong. I just think that he's not a traditional Republican fiscal conservative. I think that his main conservatism is law and order stuff.
Well, I guess what I'm saying is, because he doesn't, I mean, you say that he has positions, and maybe he does. I mean, I don't know, you know, he might, I mean, there might be a way to kind of like patch together something that like what you're talking about, but because he's so kind of saying one thing one minute and another thing another minute, or at least that's kind of
speaking to two audiences.
Well, but it's like
speaking to two audiences, speaking to the Republican base. Well, except who's going to be laughing when he wins?
Well,
it's not going to be a joke.
No, I'm not saying it is a joke. What I'm saying is, he's not encouraging. I don't really see where he's kind of helping crystallize things, because I'm kind of helping
clarify. No, he's not clarifying anything. Of course not. That's our job. I mean, the thing is, these candidates, the parties, are not interested in clarifying anything.
Well,
right. What they're interested in is getting votes. Meaning, neither of them have to have a workable policy. They just have to get votes. They don't even need like capitalists to support them. They only need votes, right? Because he doesn't really have any capitalist support. He has like a few friends or something. No, really. Like, you know, Wall Street's against him, like pretty much everybody's against him, but he doesn't need them. He can just win based on votes alone. And that's something. You know, meaning we're in the realm of ideology. we're in the realm of, you know, what people want to believe.
Yeah, well, sure.
And again, you know, the interesting thing for me about now versus the Reagan era is that, again, the question of racism has changed. Meaning in the Reagan era, I remember being in high school with kids my age who now, you know, would be Rubio Cruz type people who argued for the right to be racist. They said, I have a right to be racist. Now, if you tell a Trump voter that they're racist, they think you're insulting them. That's a big change in my lifetime. In other words, there was a time when people were like, you can't force me to change my opinions about people. You can't force me to not hate people. Whereas now, Trump voters are like, don't accuse me of hating people.
That's true.
And that's a big, big change. Well, and the Democrats are acting like that change hasn't happened.
But I mean, at the same time, you have the so-called anti-racists who, you know, they're racist.
Well, there's the whole Trump rhetoric, which flies, by the way. You know, which is that it's the Democrats who are racist. Like,
but
that,
I mean,
kind of
there's
like...
A, there's a truth to that, is what I'm saying. There is,
sure.
I mean, because the identity politics has a kind of racism.
It is, but it's more like racialism than it is racism.
Well, that's what
it's
I mean.
Like
a, I mean, yeah,
you know,
it's sort of, yeah, right.
It's like the idea that, of course, all black people should vote Democratic. Of course, all Latinos should vote Democratic. Of course, all women should vote Democratic. Of course, all gay people should vote Democratic. Which ultimately doesn't work, because it's not the case, right? In other words, there really isn't, you know, it isn't the case that, you know, the vast majority of women are going to vote for the Democrats. No. Single women are going to vote Democrat, married women are going to vote Republican, and it's been that way for a while. There's no such thing as the women's vote. There's really no such thing as the Latino vote or the black vote either, or the gay vote. Like, these things don't really exist. The Democrats want them to exist because that's their bread and butter, that's the way they work. But they don't really exist. And that's one of the things that, you know, the mendacity, right? In other words, the idea that, like, black people who vote Republican are somehow inauthentic, right? That's mendacity.
Well, the notion of a sort of inauthentic racial...
Or gender or sexual,
right,
yeah.
Right, is preposterous.
I mean, I think that, you know, liberals should be liberals and conservatives should be conservatives, meaning conservative black people should vote conservative. It should be like that. It should be straight up, you know, it shouldn't be, you know, this shaming that goes on. Madeleine Albright, right? Special place in hell for women who don't support Hillary.
Yes.
Special place in hell for people, for women who don't support Hillary. And Gloria Steinem said, the only reason why women would vote for Sanders is because they're looking for a boyfriend.
What?
Gloria Steinem, baby. And so I do think that that's where the weird, the anti-PCism is also coming from.
And that's what made me think of something going back, like the notion of back in, mm-hmm. as you explained in the Reagan era, like, you know, people would say, like, oh, I'm fighting for my right to be racist.
Mm-hmm.
I do think that that presence is still very much so alive with the Trump
support. There are some people who are like that,
whole,
I'm sure.
All right thing that's happening, like, all of, like, those groups that are backing Trump,
mm-hmm.
you know, like, white supremacism is very much so in those communities, and
there are still those people. It's true. There are still like the David Dukes of the world, etc. There are, but I think that they're of diminishing importance. And also, the question is, who's using who? Meaning, you know, in other words, are they going to use Trump to advance their agenda, or is Trump using them to get elected? You know, I mean, I always said, you know, let the KKK vote for Trump, and then he can drop them in Syria to fight ISIS. That's how you can deal with the KKK and the neo-Nazis. You know, you can kill two birds with one stone. Right? Let the fascists kill each other.
That's what they did in World War II.
That's what they did in World War II, right.
The KKK got the New Deal elected.
Yeah. That was a different time, though. I mean, it's like, it's not, in other words, it's not that racism doesn't continue to exist, but it changes. In other words, the way it works changes. And even attitudes change without the actual disadvantages affecting people changing. So the way it's rationalized, the way people understand it changes without people's condition actually improving. Right, so in other words, people, you could say, you know, in the last 30 or 40 years, people don't have the traditional racist attitudes. But that hasn't meant, for instance, for black people, it hasn't meant their material improvement. Or if it has, it's only been a certain layer of black people. Right, and so it's kind of like, how do you describe that? In other words, it's kind of like, well, if society still is disadvantageous for people, but people's attitudes are more liberal. You know, and so that's why the other thing is turning it into a culture war problem. In other words, turning it into a matter of people's attitudes. I don't think that people have to like each other in order to be political allies. And certainly the right knows that, and the left needs to understand that too. Like the neoliberals, the neoconservatives, and the Christian fundamentalists, they don't like each other. They don't respect each other at all. Right. In other words, they use the Christian fundamentalists as voting fodder, the neocons and the neoliberals, but they look down on the Christian fundamentalists. And that came out under George W. Bush, the Karl Rove memo, where it leaked that they have utter contempt for the Christian fundamentalists. And so, you know, but they work together to get something done. And the left needs to understand that concept. That's politics. In other words, it's not an affinity group, right? It's politics. And it's always a question of who's using who, then. In other words, whose interest is the alliance really to best advantage? Right? And so the right does this. They jockey for position. They use each other. They advance their agenda. And now it's falling apart. And I have to say, I'm happy that the Reagan coalition is falling apart. Because they didn't really belong together anyway.
In comparison with both candidates, I agree with you that we have two bad candidates.
Mm-hmm.
And the way, in my mind, that I'm breaking the tie is I'm thinking about after the election, whoever is elected, who is going to cause more or less
suffering. Mm-hmm.
And to whom?
And to whom.
And, you know, I just think when the people I care about are the middle and lower class. And that I don't want to see them suffer anymore. And I think if Trump is elected, they're going to be worse off than they are now.
It's possible. It's possible. I don't know that Hillary represents anything different from that.
Pardon me?
Why specifically, given like the Democratic Party's history, given like what they've done?
I think the safety net is going to be gone.
That's something already removed by
Trump. Yeah.
That was done in the Clinton administration. Clinton got rid of the safety net.
Well, I agree that
so,
you, know, you can't live on $1,500 a month that you get from Social Security now, anyhow.
No, you can't, right.
But,
I mean, one thing that struck me during the Republican debates was they were talking about Obamacare. And what Trump said was, you know, he wants to repeal and replace Obamacare, but he's not going to let anyone die in the streets. And he turned to the other candidates and he said, I know that the rest of you can't promise that you won't let people die in the streets. He's not an anti-welfare guy, Trump. He's not. That's not his deal. And in fact, Clinton is. In other words, she was asked about the welfare reform just this year, and she said that she doesn't regret it because now there are fewer deadbeats. Yeah.
Not really.
And I feel like people made a lot of hay about the crime bill. But really, the crime of the Clinton administration was welfare reform. Because there was a crime wave, there was a crime scare. I don't agree with the crime bill, but it was real. Welfare reform was not real. In other words, there was no budgetary reason why they had to do it. But Clinton promised it, and he implemented it. And he waited for the Republicans to be the majority in Congress to do it. Now, on the other hand, Trump has said that to advance his agenda, he's going to need help from Democrats because the Republicans won't follow him. In other words, to preserve Social Security, to do the infrastructure spending, he says that he's going to have to trade with the Democrats because the Republicans won't support him on that stuff. Whereas I feel like Hillary, if she's elected, there's a very good chance that she's going to throw a lot of bones to the Republicans to, as she put it, prevent Trump from ever happening again. In other words, she's going to prop up the mainstream, the Paul Ryan people, like the those Republicans. And they have a history of this, the Democrats, and Clinton in particular. So I don't know. I mean, I would not, you know, I would say that it could be that neither of them can really do much to improve the health of the, you know, the well-being of the poor people in the United States. It could be that there are things outside of the control of the U.S. president. So the only change that I see is not in terms of real things, but in terms of ideology and the electorate. In other words, it's really about, like, in other words, I don't think Reaganomics worked, like, as policy, although it appeared to, like, the economy bounced back. But I think it might have bounced back anyway. So the only thing that Reagan accomplished, he didn't fix the economy. The Soviet Union was going to collapse anyway. The only thing that he did was put together a new electoral coalition that could elect Republicans. That's the only thing that these people can do, is basically divide up the electorate. And that's what's in crisis now, because the Republicans can't win with the old electorate. And it turns out Hillary can't reproduce the Obama electorate. Like, that's been a problem all along. Like, it's been like, well, actually, and also maybe Obama himself wouldn't be able to reproduce it because the times have changed. In other words, he came in, George W. Bush was so bad, the economic crisis was so steep, the wars were so irresponsible, you know, that maybe it couldn't be reproduced now anyway. So, and that's what Bernie ran on. Bernie said he would change and expand the Democratic Party base. That's what he promised. That's also what Trump promises with the Republicans. That's what the story of this year is about. It's not about these policies, because they may or may not work anyway. The question is, how are they going to get people to vote? Because the old way, for the Republicans, isn't working. The Democrats are going to try to do it again. We'll see if they're successful. But the Republicans were definitely going to lose. Like, if it had been any of these other guys, there's no way, right? And yeah, so Trump, it's the gamble that the Republicans are making to change up the electorate. And that's all that they can do.
Well, it's true. There are always things outside of the control of a president. I mean, there was the obvious kind of like, well, there was Congress and blah, blah, blah. But I mean, but
there's also just capitalism.
Just capitalism.
Capitalism, yeah. Like, nobody really caused the financial crisis. They created the conditions that helped lead towards it, but it was a kind of contingent event.
And helped certain people make hay out of it and others suffer more. But I mean, but still, right, they Bush didn't cause it.
Right.
Chris, there are some questions on the chat, apparently.
Are there? So what are they?
They didn't. I'm not on that.
Because we're going to have to wrap up soon, aren't we?
Yeah,
there is a class.
It's like two questions. Nice.
Okay, let me see.
Hold them up.
Oh, great. Okay. We got Gregor.
Sorry, are you finishing up?
We are finishing up, yeah. You got class at 6, right?
Yeah,
yes.
We just need to get set up.
Okay. All right, so maybe we won't be able to do these questions. Gregor just made a comment. So this is a member of Platypus who's at UIC. He says, if Trump, Clinton really are just placeholders for 2020, then he says, we better hope for a Trump victory. How does he explain that? That Sanders won't run in 2020 because he's too old. Stephanie has a question. Relating back to something said earlier, how a change in the Republican Party might cause a change in the Democratic Party. Well, again, if Trump wins and if he makes a plausible case for his election not being a fluke, then the Democrats can respond one of two ways. They can basically say, maybe we should have gone with Sanders instead of Hillary, or they can double down on Hillary. And if they double down on Hillary, on Hillary-ism, then the question is, what did they do with the people who were alienated by that? In other words, they'll still be, if they lose the election, it's not as if there's a clear candidate for 2020, right? There's going to be a fight. There will be some struggle over who the Democratic Party electorate is. All right, thanks everybody.
Thank you.
Thanks.
You're the one that has to
I haven't. I've been to his place though, you know, he has a Center for Politics in Hyde Park. And so I went to the Trump debate there, but he didn't come. I thought he might come, but he's an interesting figure. I mean, I've seen him all the time.
Yeah, I thought, you know, being in the same neighborhood, you might.
He doesn't live in Hyde Park. Oh, in Hyde Park, yeah. But I'm not down there often enough.
Right there
on the corner.
Oh, yeah.
Were you
watering? Oh, well. Oh, my God. I thought,
What do you mean?
What do you mean?
Another one?